Hello, Dr. Sam Dubé here once again, the fifth doctor. You remember the time when four to five doctors recommended smoking cigarettes? Well, we're the fifth doctors. So I'm here today once again with Dr. Daniel Nagase. This is a December 27th, 2021, Monday. And Dr. Daniel Nagase was the emergency physician in British Columbia and Alberta who actually lost his job when he gave ivermectin to three patients under his care and cured them of COVID-19. And for that, he lost his job and he's been outspoken ever since. Dr. Nagase has been an emergency physician for a long time. You've been a physician for 15 years. Is that correct, Daniel?
That's right.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And he also has experience in research as well. And Daniel is known for having filed a criminal complaint for potential financial conflicts of interest with the RCMP concerning the College and Physicians of Surgeons of British Columbia. That was documented on video that occurred on Remembrance Day, November 11th, 2021. Now, the episodes where we featured Dr. Daniel Nagase, were episodes 10 and 11, and we broadcast those December 5th and 6th, 2021. Daniel, could you relate to us what has happened since then, namely the incident of December 8th with Dr. Mm-hmm. Belle Bruchet in his residence? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, before we get into that, just an update on the RCMP case where Dr. Bruchet and I, we both filed conflict of interest complaints and police reports at the North Vancouver RCMP office. So our case was assigned to a officer, Constable Jonathan Poon. but I haven't had any contact from Constable Jonathan Poon. He's been assigned to the case and he has not asked me any questions, not asked for any information. And then about a month ago, Dr. Bruchet and I went back to the same RCMP office and I dropped off a copy of the Pfizer post-marketing experience report, the one that had the 42,000 people who received the Pfizer product and how 31% of the people who received the product either died or had a severe side effect from which they were not recovering or had a side effect for which they had a permanent disability. So I forwarded that information to Constable Poon thinking, you know, this adds to the evidence supporting our police reports accusing the College of Physicians and Surgeons of BC and the Health Minister and the Premier of BC of conflict of interest. But again, this has been almost a month and I haven't heard any word from Constable Poon. But Dr. Bruchet, he's been closely involved with a lot of the things that happened, with the freedom movement trying to bring attention to the stillbirths that happened at Women's Hospital in Vancouver and just the whole encroachment and disregard for freedoms that's happening because of this excuse of a coronavirus pandemic.
Now, Daniel, could you explain mm-hmm. to our viewers and pretend that they hadn't heard anything about the increased number of stillbirths among vaccinated mothers? Can you just give us a synopsis of that, please?
So Dr. Bruchet, he's a family doctor. He's been a family doctor for longer than I've been alive, for 48 years in North Vancouver. He retired about a year and a half ago. And, you know, because he's been practicing for so long, he has so many contacts throughout the medical community, both in North Vancouver and all over Vancouver. He is a socialite when it comes to medicine. And what was brought to his attention was three doulas. So doulas are birthing assistants that give emotional and sometimes a little bit of physical support to women who are going into labor and go into the hospital. Three doulas had come to him telling him that there was a day in September where they had 13 stillbirths in a 24-hour period at Women and Children's Hospital in Vancouver. And Mel thought, oh my God, this is completely unheard of, because he used to do obstetrics as well as a part of being a full general practitioner and family doctor. And certainly, like 13 stillbirths in a month or even a year is somewhat unusual, right? Because with the amount of prenatal care pregnant women get in modern times, it's very rare to go into the hospital expecting to leave the hospital with a live baby and then to have at the very last minute to be told that, no, this was a stillbirth. The number of ultrasounds women get, the non-stress tests where they check the fetal heart rate, there's an incredible amount of surveillance in women who are pregnant leading up to the time when they go into labor and it's time for them to give birth. So to be caught by surprise and have a stillbirth is very, very rare in modern times. But since Dr. Bruce went public with that story and garnered a lot of attention with that, then the story out of Waterloo, Ontario, came to light, where someone, a nurse, had whistleblown to a former provincial prosecutor that the stats for her hospital in Waterloo was 86 stillbirths in a six-month period from January to July 1st. And so that's absolutely incredible. Like, you know, for a medium or even a large-sized hospital, stillbirths is less than one a month, right? It's a one stillbirth every 2 months is kind of the norm. And in a rare occasion, you might have one stillbirth a month for 2 months in a row. But again, it's very rare for these things to take an obstetrician or a mother by surprise.
And there didn't seem to be any other cause, any other difference than these expectant mothers had received the injections.
That's right. So the 13 stillbirths at Women's Hospital, we don't have confirmation yet that all 13 of those stillbirths had mothers who were injected. But with the situation in Waterloo, Ontario, where there was 86 stillbirths in 6 months, that has been confirmed as all those mothers had received an mRNA injection.
Oh my goodness. We need people to really wake up, you know?
Yeah.
So now Dr. Mel Bruchet was involved and is still involved in a situation that occurred December the 8th. As I understand it, you were at his residence. I believe there was another physician present as well. You were on a Zoom call for an interview with Western Standard. And then what happened?
So while I was on the Zoom call, all of a sudden we had a knock on the door and Mel went to answer his front door. And then it was two officers in masks and they tried to enter. And so they got into the atrium, the entryway of Dr. Bruchet's house, and they were questioning him very loudly, right? And then Dr. Bruchet, he saw that, you know, I was trying to do an interview in the living room, which is just kind of diagonally off of the atrium. And then he kind of ushered the officers out, and he went outside and he closed the door. But even with the front door closed, you could still overhear some very heated conversation. Dr. Charles Hoff was actually in the dining room at the time. We were preparing to go to Victoria to do the Nuremberg doctor's trial ceremony at the Victoria legislature. So Dr. Charles Hoff was there. We had Chief Popoy from the Peoples of the Salmon First Nations group, who was also there in the kitchen. And by the time I finished my Western Standard interview, I went outside to look for Dr. Bruchet, and Chief Popoy, he said, no, they took him away in handcuffs. There was three squad cars, six officers, and an RCMP mental health nurse.
So these were RCMP officers that came to arrest an 81-year-old physician from his own home. And took him away in handcuffs.
Took him away in handcuffs. This is like a riot squad. You know, if you get an emergency report, you know, there's someone downtown waving a machete or something, and it looks like they are high on cocaine or methamphetamine, or they're just out of their mind for one reason or another. Yeah, that's when you would hear stories, or you would see six officers show up to the emergency department with the suspect with a mental health issue in handcuffs, right? That's a very extreme case that, you know, you see it, you don't see it, thankfully, I don't see it very often in the emergency department, but from time to time, I do see cases where a mental health patient is brought to the ER with multiple officers. But that's only in the most violent, extreme cases.
Was Dr. Bruchet a danger to himself or others?
No. And that is the most astounding thing. Dr. Hoff was with Mel Bruchet. I was with Mel Bruchet all morning. Chief Beaupuy was with with Dr. Bruchet since about 7:15. We were having meetings. We were strategy planning what to do, because Mel has weekly freedom gatherings out in front of the RCMP offices and Lionsgate Hospital in North Vancouver. Every Sunday, he has a freedom gathering. So we were strategizing what we were going to do next after returning from Vancouver Island, because we were all going to attend the Nuremberg doctor's trial vigil at the provincial legislature. And so, again, there's no reason for three cars and six officers and a mental health nurse, so seven RCMP, you know, officers all together to show up at the store for an 81-year-old grandfather, right?
At his own home.
There's no reports of any kind of violence, and yet they're coming down with a sledgehammer.
I mean, it's almost surreal, right? Like, and typically, would it be RCMP that would come out? Is that typical? Wouldn't it be more local law enforcement if someone was very violent, or as you described, a methamphetamine case? And I mean, you would know, because you served as an emergency physician for such a long time. And this, as a physician, we've seen this happen in the Emerge. You've got vastly more experience than I do in that domain. But was this a typical response? No, it wasn't a typical response. Okay. So my question to you then, Dr. Nagase, is...
Your audio just paused.
Yeah, no, and it's okay. We'll go on. What do you think happened? And do you feel that perhaps this was in reaction, call it whatever you want, to Dr. Paul Boucher being very outspoken, attending rallies, revealing the stillbirth, the hugely disproportional number of stillbirths among the injected mothers, as well as perhaps your filing of the criminal complaint of financial conflict of interest with the College of Physicians and Surgeons of British Columbia to the RCMP? Do you think that might be?
Oh, absolutely. Because there's so many suspicious things about this case. Not only is Dr. Bruchet a pillar of the freedom and the truth movement in Vancouver, when he was taken to the hospital, he put the emergency doctor, it was Dr. Watt or Dr. Watts, I can't remember what her exact name was, and he put her on the phone, and I said to her, you know, this is what happened the night before. Dr. Bruchet, he's sleep deprived. I'm somewhat sleep deprived because there was a tenant downstairs who was extremely noisy, refused to turn down the music, and kept everyone up till about 3:30 in the morning. And, you know, Dr. Bruchet, Mel is 81 years old. He had to wake up at 7 in the morning to go pick up Chief Beaupuy from the ferries. So, you know, he's tired, but he's perfectly competent. He's of sound mind. You know, he's you know, of course he forgets things. Everyone forgets things every now and then when they're tired. But he doesn't get lost. He finds his way back home every time. He doesn't wander the streets at night. There's nothing wrong with him. And then a couple hours later, Dr. Bruchet, he calls me back and he said, they're keeping me in hospital. And I said, what for? He's like, frontal lobe dementia. The emergency doctor, Dr. Watts, she decided to sign a form to take away all of Dr. Bruchet's rights and keep him forcibly in hospital for an investigation of possible frontal lobe dementia. And I said, that's absolutely ludicrous, Mel. And Mel's like, yeah, this is, you know, why would anyone get certified for a possible dementia? That's one of those diagnoses. If someone seems confused in the emergency department and forgetful, and they don't have an infection of some sort causing the confusion, usually you call up the family or friends and say, hey, can you watch over your friend or your family member and make sure, you know, that they're, if their dementia is bad, that they're not wandering or getting lost, right? That's the normal course of action. If there's an emergency department case where somebody has dementia and confusion, mm-hmm. and they're not sick enough to require, you know, to stay in the hospital for antibiotics, is you call a friend or a family member. And yet, for some reason, even though Mel was amongst three friends who were in his house, Dr. Hoff, Chief Popoy, and me, even though there's three friends in his house, ready to take care of him, ready to pick him up from the emergency department, this emergency doctor, Dr. Watts, she signed a form and kept him in hospital involuntarily.
So a couple
and
of
then,
things. Oh, okay, go ahead. Mm-hmm. No, please.
And then so, you know, I said to Mel, it's like, do you want us just to come over there and get you out? He's like, no. Then you'll just start a fight with the emergency doctor because she's really adamant that I have to stay in the hospital for a PET scan first thing in the morning. And I said,
tomography, right.
And of course, with the emergency department at Lionsgate Hospital, if you're not vaccinated, they won't even let you in the doors, right? Like, if you're a walk-in patient, they won't even let you in to the waiting room. They'll make you wait outside in the cold if you aren't vaccinated.
Right? So, no matter what the medical condition?
No matter what. So unless you're so ill that you came in by ambulance, there's no direct way into the emergency department if you're unvaccinated. They stop you at the door to check your vaccine status.
Restricted, biased medical care against the unjabbed.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
This is not, it's an embarrassment to call Lionsgate Hospital emergency department, an emergency department. What, turning away someone because they're not vaccinated? After all the staff worked for an entire year of 2020, treating coronavirus patients without any vaccine, and all of a sudden now the staff are too scared now after working a year with the coronavirus pandemic. Now that there's a vaccine out, they're too scared to take care of an unvaccinated patient. What an embarrassment. What an embarrassment to emergency nursing. What an embarrassment to emergency doctors, right?
Unbelievable.
No, that is just wrong.
And after we finish talking about Dr. Bruchet, we're gonna speak further about what's happening in hospitals lately, because you have a story you'd like to tell, and I do too. Now, mm-hmm. another thing is that you have Dr. Mel Bruchet's permission to speak, okay? I just wanna let our viewers know. And the second thing is, basically they were saying that they're holding him because they think he's potentially cognitively impaired, but but he's been really outspoken about the mandates and the restrictions and the stillbirths. He reported on the stillbirths. He broke that story. And so it's almost like they're saying that he's can only be cognitively impaired for having these beliefs or for taking these actions. That's what it sounds like.
That's what it sounds like. He's been held for almost 3 weeks in a psychiatric ward.
Unbelievable.
Three weeks.
And they reviewed his situation as well, medically correct. And, mm-hmm. and didn't they recertify him again?
Exactly. They recertified him as an involuntary patient. And now the extra diagnosis that they tacked on is a diagnosis of mania.
So they think he's got a psychosis?
No, they didn't make the accusation of psychosis. They just made the accusation he's manic.
Okay.
Right? Now there's true mania where people they feel like $1 million, and then, you know, they go out gambling, yeah. They empty their bank accounts at the casino, you know, they buy whatever $500 bottles of champagne, and they pay for an open bar at the bar at the casino. You know, there's true mania where people are literally, they are high as a kite, but they never
took any boundless energy to get something done.
Exactly. The only kind of mania Mal has is that he is motivated. He has so much, he has more energy than I do in terms of organizing, phoning people up, getting protests organized, getting, you know, stillbirth props, signs, right?
Okay, well, at least they didn't diagnose him as having a psychotic break. That's good. And the video has frozen here momentarily. It will come back. There you go.
Oh.
You're back. It's okay.
Am I back?
Yeah. Just a busy time for the internet. Sorry. Yeah. So please go on.
So Mel has boundless energy, boundless creativity in terms of getting props and getting people's attention. Right? He's not out, you know, spending like the world is going to end tomorrow, emptying his bank account, you know, driving faster than the speed limit, you know, making girlfriends with the people a quarter of his age. No,
right,
he's
right,
yeah. That is what true mania is. Someone loses all their inhibitions, and it's literally, as the millennials call it, YOLO. You only live once, so might as well spend it all. Right.
So you don't feel that these diagnoses are justified?
No, it's absolutely unjustified. And the thing is, Svetlana, she's the nurse who started the Ezra parallel healthcare system in BC and Alberta. She and I went to the hospital on Saturday, December the 11th. We just returned from the Nuremberg event in Victoria. And we demanded to speak to the psychiatrist on call. The charge nurse refused to let us speak to the psychiatrist on call, called the RCMP. They sent 3 squad cars, 6 officers for a nurse and a doctor who were pressing the buzzer outside the psychiatric hospital saying, we want to speak to the psychiatrist on call about Dr. Mel Brochet. And then the officer said, oh, now is not the time to be calling the psychiatrist on call because it was at 10:30 at night. And I argued with these RCMP officers for almost half an hour. And at the end of it, the argument, I said, listen, a psychiatrist gets paid more per hour than anyone standing here to take phone calls no matter what the time of day. And I'll tell you that because half of my career as an emergency doctor has been as an on-call emergency doctor, or sometimes I'm on call for 7 days in a row or 10 days in a row. And I get paid an hourly fee to take phone calls to see patients no matter what the time of day. So finally, the officers gave up on trying to shoo us away, and the charge nurse phoned the psychiatrist on call. Psychiatrist on call was atrocious. He didn't know the diagnosis for Mel Brochet. He hadn't rounded on Mel Brochet, and he was trying to make excuses that, you know, well, he only has to round on the patients that the nurses ask him to round on. And I said, like, I'm an on-call doctor. At the beginning of your on-call set, if you're the doctor on for the weekend, do you not get a list of all the patients you're responsible for and their diagnoses? Do you not round on all your patients? That's what you get paid to do, because that's what I get paid to do. Anyhow, it wasn't the psychiatrist took offense at me telling him how to do his job as an on-call doctor, but so that conference, he ended up hanging up on the phone on it. But the next morning, he rounded on Dr. Brochet, and he gave Dr. Brochet a day pass, an 8-hour day pass. So on the Sunday, as regularly happens in North Vancouver on Sunday, there's the Mel Brochet rally. And we actually organized the rally that it was a rally to get people together to show support for Dr. Mel Brochet because he's being held involuntarily in the psych ward.
Now, what was the date, the exact date? That was the 11th or the 12th of December?
That was the 12th.
The 12th.
The next day, after Svetlana and I, you know, I hate to say disciplined, but basically we disciplined the psychiatrist on call for not doing his on-call duties. The next day, Mel was released on a day pass. So we had about 450 people in the sleet, in the rain, under a tent, who had gathered in the square outside of North Vancouver City Hall. So there was a decent-sized crowd, especially considering the terrible weather. And then Mel Brochet, he got up and he spoke at his own support rally while he was on day pass. And he spoke for about 20 minutes, just telling the crowd, you know everyone's worried about me because I'm in the hospital. What really, what this is about the stillbirths. This is about the side effects. And, you know, always just the generous soul that he is. He's like, stop worrying about me. I'm going to get out of the psychiatric hospital. They have no reason to keep me here in the hospital. You know, let's get back to business, you know, bringing attention to the stillbirths. And clearly you can see from the video, because we had videographers at the event, that Mel's of sound mind. He's not threatening harm to anyone. He's not threatening harm to himself. Yeah. And he's perfectly coherent.
And I'll link to that video in the description of this episode. I will do that, okay? So people can see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I thought for sure, and he insisted that, you know, he was going to go back to the hospital at 6 p.m., just like he had agreed with the psychiatrist on call. He wasn't going to say, yeah, I'm out of the hospital. I'm never going back, right? He's like, no, I'm going to do things properly. And they gave me a day pass. I'm going to honor the 8 hours of the day pass. And I thought for sure, given that he's, you know, honored the day pass, he spoke publicly, he was coherent in public, there's video evidence, I thought for sure, Monday he would be released. But no, on Monday he was told he had to see a geriatric psychiatrist. So his regular psychiatrist in Lionsgate Hospital psych ward is Dr. Lim. And Dr. Lim would not release him from certification until he saw the geriatric psychiatrist. So then that delayed things till Tuesday. The geriatric psychiatrist did not even see him on Tuesday. She sent a psychiatry resident to assess him. So then on Tuesday, that's the 14th, that was the last we heard from Dr. Bruchet regularly by phone. Because every day he would call multiple times during the day, you know, either myself, Svetlana, or any of his number of friends to try and keep the publicity and the protests and the organizing rolling, even from the psych ward, he was trying to arrange things. And then they cut off his access to the phone.
Oh.
So Tuesday, December 14th was when the phone calls from Mel became very sporadic. Like I hear from him maybe once every 3 or 4 days when he can sneak the phone from another psychiatry patient. Like another psychiatry patient who does have phone privileges is using the phone and lets Mel have the phone right after before the nurses can take it away.
Okay, well, we better keep that on the down low, right?
Right. So then now he's had his phone access restricted on the 14th. We don't know what the geriatric psychiatrist said about him. And then a week later, so on the 21st, then he has his review panel meeting where all the consult notes from the original psychiatrist, Dr. Lim, and the geriatric psychiatrist specialist, Dr. Kang, her notes are all put together and then they have a presentation at a review panel. And the conclusion from the review panel is that Mel has to be recertified and kept in hospital as an involuntary patient. And the new diagnosis that was added onto the previous diagnosis of frontal lobe dementia was now mania.
Right.
Despite the video evidence showing the contrary.
So what is his situation right now, today being...
So right now, I did get a phone call from him yesterday, and he said they were forcibly medicating him with aripiprazole, or it's called Abilify is the trade name. And that was started on him by force on Friday. And he said what Dr. Lim, the psychiatrist, said to him is you either take this medication or we hold you down and we inject it into you. And so the problem with aripiprazole, and Mel Bruchet, he read the insert from the drug, the pill box, and aripiprazole has a warning on the manufacturer's own dosing sheet. It says it's warning not to be used in the elderly due to risk of stroke. And if you actually do 10 minutes of research on PubMed, there is study after study, meta-analysis after meta-analysis, showing antipsychotics, of which aripiprazole or Abilify is an antipsychotic, when it's used in the elderly, it causes an increased number of strokes, and especially in the extreme elderly. So it's an increased risk at 65, but once a patient's in their 80s and 90s, antipsychotics are deadly. They cause strokes. And so that's the reason why you're not supposed to use antipsychotics in someone who's over the age of 65, and certainly not in someone who's age 80 or above, which is Mel Bruchet's case. He's age 81. And I got to talk to Dr. Bruchet for a few minutes on Sunday. So this was yesterday around 11 o'clock noon. And his speech was slow, and he had trouble remembering names. And Mel, he is faster with names. He's a motor mouth. He will talk. And his speech was slow. It was stuttered, and it was, it sounded like he had word finding difficulty because he couldn't remember names that normally he would remember. He would have no problems. He would just rattle off names like, through a phone book of all the people who need to be contacted, who need to be updated in terms of getting this movement and keeping this movement moving forward. And so I thought, he's been forced to take this medication for 3 days. He's not his usual self. His speech is not his usual self. I can't tell from the other end of the phone line whether or not he's had a stroke. So I called the Lionsgate Hospital switchboard. I said, hey, this is Dr. Nagasi. Can I have the neurologist on call for Lionsgate Hospital? And then she gives me the pager number for a Dr. Wong. So I call him. It's actually his cell phone. So I call Dr. Wong and I said, hi, I'm Dr. Nagasi. There's a patient who's being held on the psychiatry ward, and he's had speech changes. He's now had slurred speech from what I've known of him before. He's having word-finding difficulty, and he doesn't seem his usual self. And, Dr. Wong's like, oh, okay, what's the age of the patient? I said, 81. And it's like, what's the comorbidity? He's like, well, he's had high blood pressure. And, I listed the high blood pressure medications he's on. And so, again, at the age of 80, with a history of high blood pressure, of course, you're already at a risk of a stroke, right? And then for a psychiatrist to ignore manufacturer warnings, to ignore the scientific evidence, and then add a medication to Dr. Bruchet's daily medications that's known to cause strokes, it's absolutely criminal. So, I still haven't had an update yet whether or not the neurologist, Dr. Wong, did a consult yet on him. But I'm hoping that Mel did receive a neurology consult, and that the neurologist who went to see him in person said, certainly if it was a TIA or a mini stroke or a full-blown stroke causing the speech disturbance, then certainly any drugs that are involved in making a stroke worse, like an antipsychotic, must be stopped immediately. So I'm still waiting to hear back to see if we manage to get the antipsychotic that's been forced upon Dr. Mel Bruchet. We've managed to get that stopped.
And you're an you're an emergency physician, and so this is something you would know about. And also, if they really wanted to prescribe an antipsychotic, antipsychotics for someone 81 years old in his situation are very dangerous, as you've mentioned, and the risks are far beyond any potential benefits. And you're not even convinced these diagnoses are justifiable, and they did it anyway. So this sounds more than suspicious, and there's a sense of urgency now, because if he did have a TIA or a stroke, they need to stop that medication. And
exactly.
And he needs to be assessed by a neurologist. Absolutely, like pronto. This is just unreal. And now, so Daniel, potentially how long can he be held? All right, because he's got these diagnoses, so they can lawfully hold him against his will, but are the diagnoses real diagnoses? Are they legitimate diagnoses? I should say real. They're real because they're holding, but are they the legitimate? And secondly, then what can people do about this situation? Because I know viewers are and listeners are questioning this right now. Is there anything, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but you know, something has to be done.
Well, something has to be done, because when they recertified him on the 21st, that means that he's not allowed to have another review until 14 days later. If my understanding of the Mental Health Act is correct, that review panel that met and concluded that he had to be certified, their certification is valid for 14 days. And so in the meantime, since having restricted his phone access, just this past week, lawyers have been allowed to get through to him, because previously the hospital staff, the nurses, and the unit clerk were not even allowing lawyers to speak to him.
Yeah,
and the lawyers have made enough of a legal challenge or a legal threat that they finally started allowing Mel to talk to a lawyer. So he's got two lawyers who are working on his case, trying to get him out. But again, this is like, I don't know what can be done. It's a criminal situation where a patient is being forced to take a medication that could kill him. And the Mental Health Act allows for this assault to occur.
So the medical authorities know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing.
And then, you know, when they first restricted Mel's phone access, a bunch of his friends and myself, we tried to get the RCMP to, you know, call the hospital and say, no, phone access is a basic right. Stop restricting access for Dr. Mel Bruchet. Stop restricting his access to the phone. The police wouldn't get involved. The RCMP office. That's a crime that's in progress. A person is being violated his rights, his charter rights to communicate with other people. And his charter rights are being violated by criminality from the nurses and the psychiatrists on the psychiatry floor. And the RCMP refused to get involved. We even tried to get a wellness check, because RCMP, under the Mental Health Act, they're allowed to do wellness checks. If somebody, a concerned citizen, phones in and says, I believe somebody is unwell, can you do a wellness check as the RCMP? So we even had one of Mel's friends try to call the RCMP and said, we need to do a wellness check on Dr. Mel Bruchet in the psychiatry ward, because his friends cannot verify that he is in good health and he is not being mistreated, because we're not allowed to talk to him on the phone. The RCMP flat out refused. They said, he's under the care of the doctors. There's no reason for the police to get involved with a wellness check. And the RCMP were told that, no, it's the doctors who might be abusing the patient. And they refused to even take a report to do a wellness check on a patient in the hospital.
Wow. You know, this is potentially criminal. I mean, criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Professor Dolores Cahill in the UK is spearheading an effort to emphasize the liability of men and women who reinforce and enact the mandates and restrictions and violate human rights and such. And this will have worldwide implications. And I do want to talk to an incident relating to that very recently. So there isn't much we can do for Dr. Mel Bruchet at this time. He's got these 14-day reviews, and you are continually trying to communicate with him, and he's allowed the phone access now, so I don't have to edit that part out. And this is just really unconscionable. It's shocking, and I'm glad we spoke about this. Thank you, Dr. Daniel Nagase. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you would like to add regarding this?
No, it's unconscionable, you know, that the RCMP would have the resources to spare to send six officers to an 81-year-old person's house, but they only have one officer assigned who apparently doesn't have enough time to contact me about the case of an entire executive board at the College of Physicians and Surgeons having a conflict of interest. They have one constable assigned who doesn't have the time for me.
Right, and a board who are making declarations and mandates that are affecting people's thousands upon thousands of people's lives, potentially deadly consequences there. And this is what you're working towards. Well, you know, they got Al Capone on tax evasion, right? You have to try and get them somehow. Mm-hmm. So with that, I want to shift, and thank you so much for speaking to this, Doc. I know it's not easy for you, Daniel. I know. And you did allude to this in our last interview, but I really wanted to bring this out and let people know. The public has to know what's happening here. Now, you received a phone call from a very distressed woman fairly recently regarding a case in the hospital with her husband. Can you please tell us that whole story? Yes.
So it was actually a set of emails that I received.
Okay, sorry, my apologies.
This case happened in Edmonton. This father of three, 47 years old, you know, in relatively good shape, is at 47. He went into a community hospital with COVID-like symptoms and low oxygen. He was transferred from the community hospital to Edmonton ICU because of his deteriorating respiratory status. Now, the hospital didn't send the full medical records. They just sent out printouts of what was on the electronic medical records on the computer system in Alberta. So it was mainly just the doctor's consult notes. But from what I gather is, even though he was conscious and breathing, but he had low oxygen saturations, the ICU doctors in Edmonton decided that they needed to intubate him and put him on mechanical ventilation. So for me as an emergency doctor, and you know, maybe I'm a bit more experienced than the average emergency doctor, if a person is thinking, you know, and talking back to you, right, and is alert and they don't have a glazed over look on their eyes, it doesn't matter what their oxygen number is. If they're getting enough oxygen that their brain can think and they can answer questions, I don't put anyone on mechanical ventilation. I sit there and wait and see if they can recover on their own, or if they get worse and they no longer are getting enough oxygen to their brain, then I can always put them on mechanical ventilation then. There's no rush. When you are doing your job with excellence as an emergency doctor, you're not a neurotic wreck. You're actually an experienced, you're paying attention to the patient, you're focused, you're in the zone. There's no rush to put someone on a mechanical ventilator. But for some reason, this 47-year-old was put on a mechanical ventilator. And they didn't try anything before that. They didn't try a BiPAP machine. They didn't do anything that could have prevented mechanical ventilation. They just
Did they
jumped.
Give oxygen?
They gave oxygen, and then they gave a non-rebreather oxygen with extra nasal prongs. Mm-hmm. But as far as I can tell from the consult note from the doctor, is he wasn't actually unconscious before they decided to put him on the mechanical ventilator. They just did it as a precaution, which to me is it's the sign of a very novice emergency doctor who doesn't know what they're doing, or it's just a poor clinical decision.
Daniel, forgive me, but isn't mechanical ventilation kind of a last resort? And we've been seeing very low SATs with COVID patients in the hospital who are functional, right? And we've been seeing that at very low SATs that normally we would consider incompatible with life. But this has been going on now for how long, right? 2 years. So as you said, this is a sign of a very novice emergency department to throw someone a mechanical ventilation who was with it and functional.
That's right. And then so after they put him on mechanical, so just a short circuit to the end of the story, this 47-year-old died. But the thing was, they put him on the mechanical ventilation, and as soon as he was unconscious on a mechanical ventilator, they started an experimental drug on this man, on this 47-year-old father. They started a medication called baricitinib, which is it's an immune modulator normally used for patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis. And the justification is this immune modulator will dial down the immune system so that there's less inflammation in the lungs, and it will help people recover from their COVID pneumonia and the inflammation in the lungs from the COVID pneumonia. It will reduce that inflammation and help them recover faster. But it's normally a rheumatoid arthritis drug. And the thing is, from the research on rheumatoid arthritis patients, baricitinib has been known to cause blood clots in the lungs, specifically pulmonary emboli. So even though it decreases the inflammation, it increases the chances of a blood clot. So why would you even bother using such a dangerous medication, A, on someone who doesn't have rheumatoid arthritis, right? And then as soon as this father, this 47-year-old father of three, is unconscious, the ICU doctor started experimenting on him. You know, if they wanted to go the anti-inflammatory route and use like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus drugs, they could have just used hydroxychloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine has a 40, 50-year history of being safe, not causing blood clots in rheumatoid arthritis, lupus patients, or even just arthritis without any known cause patients. Hydroxychloroquine is a proven safe anti-inflammatory for over-inflammation syndromes, right? So if you want to put, if you think that COVID-19 pneumonia is an inflammation syndrome, an autoimmune syndrome like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, then the safest thing to try is hydroxychloroquine. But these ICU doctors in Edmonton, it's absolutely disgusting. They pick the most dangerous rheumatoid arthritis anti-inflammatory immune modulator drug, and then they experiment on a 47-year-old father of three.
While he's mechanically ventilated.
This makes me furious.
Yeah. Yeah. And we know there are sequential multi-drug treatments that can be used. There are literally drugs that have been proven, monoclonal antibodies. Why didn't they use those if they're going to use something along the lines of a biologic? And as you mentioned, hydroxychloroquine. And then, of course, there's always the ivermectin. But no, instead, they put the patient at serious risk. So what ended up happening?
So what ended up happening is the patient recovered from the ICU, was taken off of mechanical ventilation, and was recovering on the general ward. And then 2 days later, he suffered a cardiac arrest. And the notes from the ICU doctor who went to attend to the cardiac arrest, while they were doing the CPR and trying to bring him back to life, they did an ultrasound of his heart. And on the ultrasound of his heart, the ICU doctor's note was that he saw that the right ventricle, the right side of the heart, was filled with a lot of blood. And the left side of the heart, the ventricles were collapsed. So the left side of the heart wasn't getting enough blood. So if the right side of the heart has plenty of blood, the left side of the heart doesn't have any blood, that means the blockage is somewhere between the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart. And of course, the blockage, that would mean that the circulatory blockage is in the lungs. Which
like
for someone under
20,
that's right, that's a pulmonary embolism, right? Because you have someone with a 47-year-old lung. So those are still relatively healthy lungs. For a blockage to be so massive that no blood is getting to the left heart, but the right heart has plenty of fluid, that means that's a massive pulmonary embolus. That's like a saddle embolus, where no blood is getting through the lungs because the blood clot is that big.
So they prematurely...
And this happened to him after he was discharged from the ICU.
Oh my gosh.
And the other thing is, you know, when patients are in hospital, they usually get a low molecular weight heparin or some kind of anticoagulant to prevent them from getting blood clots.
Yeah, blood thinner.
And so, at least according to the notes, this gentleman, this 47-year-old father, he was getting injections of blood thinners.
Mm-hmm.
But in spite of the blood thinners, they gave him such a toxic and dangerous drug while he was in the ICU unconscious that he got a massive saddle embolus in spite of the fact he was still on blood thinners.
Wow. So not only did they prematurely ventilate while he was out and on mechanical ventilation, they gave him essentially an experimental drug, which they didn't need to give him, known for causing pulmonary emboli in patients when there were several other alternatives, including similar biologics. And they opted for that one. The patient recovered, was taken off mechanical ventilation, was discharged from a hospital, presumably, right? Or the
from other, the ICU.
From the ICU.
He was on the floor.
So he was on the floor. So he was under standard care at that point. And he dies, and the notes show that there was potentially, because his right heart was enlarged, potentially there was a blockage in the lungs, for example, a pulmonary embolism or pulmonary emboli. And this is very frustrating and enraging.
Like, it makes me so upset. Like, I know the sentiment that ICU doctors can have, where they're faced every day with patients who are critically ill, and you want to try everything possible to make the patient better. I understand that sentiment as an ICU doctor, because, you know, as an emergency doctor, you have to be an ICU doctor part of the time, because the ICU doctor doesn't come down from the ICU right away. Depending on how busy things are, as the emergency doctor, if you have to put someone on life support, you might have to be an ICU doctor for 4 hours or even 6 hours until the ICU doctor comes downstairs. So as an emergency doctor, you're basically an ICU doctor. So I understand completely the sentiment that, you know, you want to do everything you can for your patient, even if something hasn't been proven to work yet, you want to give it a try. I understand that. But the fact that they chose the most toxic immune modulating drug possible, one that's been proven to cause blood clots in rheumatoid arthritis patients, and some of the case reports for baricitinib, the case reports is like, yeah, the blood clots don't always happen while you're on the medication. When the medication stops, the increased pulmonary embolism risk lasts for 2 weeks after the medication stopped. This is an extremely toxic drug. It's not one of those drugs that you stop the drugs 4 hours or 6 hours later, it's out of your system, and then you're back to normal. This immune modulating drug is toxic, and it has long toxic after effects even after you stop it.
Hey, but Dr. Nagase, you know, they're playing with the whole idea of who's injected and not, because if you suffer an adverse effect or a death within 2 weeks of your final injection, you're not vaccinated. So why not mess with the temporal relationship here? Why not?
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is ridiculous. And you mentioned to me that the death occurred, sadly, November the 6th. When were the medical records released?
So the medical records were released to the family on November 29th. So that's 23 days after death. So over 3 weeks. And then it went from the family to the family advocate, who passed on the medical records to me. And they weren't even complete medical records. It's just literally a unit clerk or some medical records office clerk went to the computer and just clicked print out for all the doctor's notes that she saw on the computer system, and then scanned them and handed it to the family. The medical records didn't include nurse's notes, vital signs, all the handwritten notes that come with a paper chart. This is literally the laziest possible medical records release you could imagine. It's someone clicking a few clicks on a computer, printing it out, scanning it, and handing it to the family. And that took 23 days.
Unreal.
Wow. They didn't even include x-ray reports. They didn't include the blood test reports. They didn't include CT scan reports. It was just the doctor's notes. And so I don't know what kind of paperwork the family had to fill out just to get the medical records. And then they're told that these are the medical records for their deceased father. It's wrong. No. Like, it's another, whatever, 25 clicks to send the medical imaging reports, the CT scan reports, the x-ray reports, and the blood test reports. 20, 25 clicks maximum to print all that out and attach that to the chart as well.
So an incomplete medical record and also delayed in getting to the family. Wow. And you know what's really sad here, Daniel, is that if any fact checkers were to look at this video, they would see what you're saying and be like, well, no, no, that medication couldn't possibly have caused the emboli. And, you know, they're known to be safe. And no, he's not right. He's not accurate. He's not up to date. And besides, it was an emergency, and we're authorized to do this in an emergency, you know, and just excuse after excuse after lie after lie. It just doesn't end, you know, like the real science doesn't matter anymore because, oh, an individual claimed that he was science, right? And so, well, you know, that their science goes out the window there, right? What we're seeing is scientism. You think the best scientists are in the CDC? No. Yeah. You think the best scientists are in the FDA and the WHO? No. They're bureaucrats. They were created to guide, and they work for the people. They work for the people. They work for us. Mm-hmm. And when there's huge conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest and power conflicts of interest, how can you accept guidelines from organizations that directly financially benefit from the sale and administration of the product that they're issuing guidelines for? You know what I mean? That's a huge no. And I'm sorry to go on here, Daniel. I would love for you to have the last word, please. Is there anything else you would like to discuss today?
You know, it's, I think for me, it's hard to find forgiveness for like the psychiatrists who knowingly give an 80-year-old man an antipsychotic that will give him a stroke, right? It's very hard for me to find forgiveness. And I try to take step away from it, kind of find, to look at it from a bigger perspective. And what I realize is it's a choice, right? It's a choice where what is more important, your mortgage or your finances or your soul? And that's as simple as I can put it to maybe some doctor who's like, well, I know remdesivir is wrong, but I'm just going to follow the protocols because I don't want the hospital administrator to fire me. And the message that I imagine myself, you know, saying to a doctor like that, I have this tendency to fury because it's such an embarrassment to the whole idea of being a physician that you would put your mortgage above your patient. But really, that's what it is. It's a choice to either have justice, the excellence of your soul, and bring that to your profession, or to have greed and degrade your soul by bringing injustice to your profession, saying, you know what, my car payment for the lease of whatever, right? A Maserati or something, a lease payment is more important than my patient's life. That's what it boils down to. And I hope, like, if there are any doctors who are sitting on the fence, who might be listening in, the choice is what changes you for eternity versus what changes you for whatever. Like, how long does a Maserati last? Like 10 years before it's a junk? Like before, like, it costs more to maintain than, like, I don't know, the maintenance must be expensive on boutique cars. But, like, what is truly the long-term decision, right? The temporary, the material world, or the eternal and the divine world? And if I can help people by trying to stay positive and not getting angry, because I do have a tendency to, for that anger, is if I can get people to see that there's more than the material world of next month's payment, next year's payment, or the 10 years left on the mortgage, that there's actually something greater that exists in every single one of us that lasts more than 10 years. It's called your soul. And there's decisions you make in life, and you have a choice. Do I choose for eternity, or do I choose for the temporary benefits of the material world? And that's a message I'd hope to get out.
And The other thing is that you have to live with yourself, right? Right. Now, let me ask you this last question here, Daniel, while I think of it. Do you think more physicians and researchers who are sitting on the fence would come out if there was some type of amnesty available for them? I'm not saying we can produce this. The governing bodies are there. But if there were alternatives, if there was a way to give them an amnesty of sorts, do you think more would come forward? Do you think that's a thought to entertain?
That's a great idea. Mm-hmm. To have an amnesty, a forgiveness, and a chance to make it up. Not just forgiveness is, you know, what's the thing that bothers me the most, that makes me most furious right now? It's the Edmonton ICU doctors, right, who experimented on this 47-year-old father. And, you know, I really have to stretch my soul to be better and to say, you know, I forgive you for harming a patient. But it's not an empty forgiveness where, you know, I forgive you and then you go off in the world and you do whatever you want. No, I'd want it to be a meaningful forgiveness where you're forgiven, but now you have to practice to the excellence of an ICU doctor, which means your consideration is the best of your knowledge, the best of your research into doing the best you can for that patient who's on life support. And if it means getting in trouble with administration, if it means possibly being fired by administration because you're using hydroxychloroquine and zinc and ivermectin, it means that although you've been forgiven for past transgressions, the choice you have now is to choose better, right? And to take a stand, make choices based on courage, not choices based on fears of the material world.
And with that, Daniel, I think we'll adjourn for now. I'm sure our viewers were very, very happy to hear from you and hear the stories and the updates. And with that, then I'm Dr. Sam Dubé for The Fifth Doctor. I guess that makes anyone on this show The Fifth Doctor. I want to thank Dr. Daniel Negesse, emergency physician, activist now, and compassionate human being. Thanks for joining us today, Daniel. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dubé.
It's Sam, remember? It's Sam.
Sam. Thank you very much, Sam.
Bye-bye.